This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Hello and happy Friday, everybody, and welcome to the Men's Hour, brought to you by Mind's Eye, your virtual newsstand. Well, it is cold as all get out, and I, for one, am getting ready to go to Florida here in a couple weeks. And I live there 5 or 6 months a year, and I live in St. Louis 5 or 6 months a year, and try to enjoy the best of both places. So I'll tell you what, it's been cold. So hopefully you've been staying warm. And let's get into some reading here. I decided on a story from Reader's Digest. I used to read this all the time when I was little. My parents got it. I remember my grandma having it. And you always can see it in, you know, doctor's offices. But it's actually a really good magazine with some great personal interest stories and things that are, you know, things that are interesting to men too, I think. So I hope you enjoy this one. It's called Two Terrific Attacks, One Forever Love Story. He survived multiple shark bites. She was hit in the Boston Marathon bombing. Then they found each other. Colin Cook remembers the moments just before. Water lapped against his legs as he straddled his surfboard 100 yards from the shore of Leftovers Beach on Oahu. He'd been out some 2 hours already, and he felt exhausted but happy. He looked the part of a seasoned surfer that October morning in 2015. Shaggy reddish-brown hair, broad shoulders, lithe build, his 5'10" frame snug in board shorts and a wetsuit top. He'd moved to Hawaii from his childhood home in Rhode Island for moments like this. Out here at age 25, he could live life slowly. Back east, everyone lived at the frenetic pace of achievement. Almost as an act of defiance, Colin had come out to Oahu and rented a literal walk-in closet in a house owned by the guy he worked for, a manufacturing entrepreneur and a surfer himself. The closet was 4 feet wide and 15 feet long. With the cot Colin bought to sleep on, there was no room to maneuver, but it was steps from a front door that opened onto the beach. Sounds pretty good. Colin owned 15 surfboards and acted like a pro surfer, even though he wasn't one. He told himself in those days he didn't want to turn pro. He thought competitions would taint what he loved. Instead, he glassed, the slow, careful process of fiberglassing and sealing surfboards. It was not at all like the career his dad had as a sports apparel executive and not the life his sister had created as an Ivy League graduate. Amid the beauty of Oahu, Colin tormented himself with questions about why he didn't have his father's ambition or his sister's intelligence. The only answer that quieted his mind, he had found, lived in the barrel of the next wave. I'm just going to get a couple more in, he thought, that morning in 2015. A couple more waves before paddling in to get ready for work. Then the force hit him like an 18-wheeler. He was instantly underwater and disoriented from the impact, and then above water, desperate for breath, and then pulled under once more, even more violently. Colin saw the flash of a tiger shark, twice as long as he was, biting down on his left leg. He punched the shark on its nose again and again and again. The shark thrashed from the blows, butted Colin, then pulled away. He rose to the surface. Panicked, panting, he grabbed his surfboard and tried to paddle ashore. He looked behind him for the shark, but saw something else. His left leg, just above the knee, gone. Blood reddened the blue waters. Colin saw the shark's fin close on him. Help, he yelled. Shark attack. I'm going to die out here, Colin thought. Already the shark was on him. Colin pushed and punched for his life, and somehow the beast turned away from him again. The first three fingers of Colin's left hand hung at nauseating backward and sideways angles. Colin scrambled onto his board. The open wound of the stump that had been his left leg shot out blood in time with his heartbeat. His vision blurred and darkened. Colin fought to stay awake. Suddenly, a large Polynesian man stood near him on a stand-up paddleboard. The man clubbed the shark with his paddle until it swam away. He tossed his safety leash to Colin, but Colin couldn't grab it because of his mangled hand and the blood that dripped from the rope, slicking it. The shark returned, its dorsal fin parting the water even faster than it had the first two times, the beast more furious than ever. "Tell my family I love them," Colin gasped. The man ditched the paddle, heaved Colin onto his back, lay chest down on his board, and swam for it. The shark followed the whole way. Sydney Corcoran, too, remembers the moments just before. With her parents, Celeste and Kevin Corcoran, she was watching runners approach the finish line of the Boston Marathon on that overcast April 2013 afternoon. Sydney, 17 at the time, wore a sweatshirt and a down jacket. It was 47 degrees, but a party there on Boylston Street. Celeste and Sydney inched between the revelers and the metal fencing the city had erected along the sidewalk. Celeste's sister, Carmen Acabo, was running her first marathon, and they all planned to celebrate when she finished. Around 2:45 p.m., Celeste and Sydney jostled their way even with the yellow finish line. As they waited for Acabo to come into view, it was hard not to cheer for themselves a bit, too. 3 years earlier, Sydney had crossed a pedestrian walkway on Massachusetts' North Shore and was struck by a car. She had bounced off its windshield and hit the pavement so hard that her older brother, Tyler Corcoran, was sure she was dead. Well after Sydney was released from the hospital, the brain bleeding and swelling caused such headaches she could attend her public school in Lowell, Massachusetts, only every other day. By the time she stood close to Celeste at the finish line that April afternoon, Sydney had worked through physical pain, anger, guilt, and depression. She finally felt peace. The worst, Celeste said, was behind them. Then came a noise loud enough to blow out Celeste's eardrums. She felt as if she'd been flipped in the air. She looked around. Black smoke clouded Boylston Street. Blown out plated glass was scattered across the sidewalk, and blood was everywhere. Celeste tried to sit up and couldn't. Tried to locate Sydney and couldn't. Kevin told her he was going to cinch her legs with a belt. She looked down and saw that her legs dangled by the skin around her knees. The blood pumped out in time with her heartbeat. Kevin tied the belt tight, hoping to staunch the blow of blood. The pain was excruciating. Out of Celeste's vision, line of vision, lay Sydney. A part of the detonation mechanism in the homemade bomb that had just exploded had rocketed through Sydney's right quadriceps and snicked the femoral artery of her upper thigh. She was bleeding out. Sydney could feel that something was wrong. Her right leg wouldn't move the way her brain was telling it to. There was too much smoke to locate her parents. People ran around her. Their faces looked terrified. Some were covered in blood. "Where are Mom and Dad?" she thought. "Am I an orphan now?" Sydney put pressure on her right foot in an effort to stand, and she passed out. She came to. A Marine was tying a tourniquet made of t-shirts tight around her leg. She gasped from the pain. The Marine told another guy, Matt Smith, to put pressure on the wound in her leg. Sydney's thoughts moved beyond the pain. Are there more bombs? Will I survive them? Her vision blurred, then darkened. Smith pressed his forehead to hers. "Just squeeze my hand. Keep talking," he said. She nodded, but time warped. When she came to, she was in a medical tent erected for marathon runners, but now for survivors of the bombing. People told each other, "Her eyes are white, lips are purple, get her in an ambulance." She wanted to say how much this talk scared her, but she couldn't speak. She was so cold. Why was her family not here? Next, she was in an ambulance, and pain pulsed through her leg with every pothole and corner. While someone hovered in and out of her vision, everything turned white and fuzzy. "I know I'm going," she thought, "and I had an okay run." Colin Cook looked around the hospital room at the Queens Medical Center in Honolulu and remembered snippets of the lost hours. The paddleboarder, his chest to his board, and Colin sure he'd die. Words that floated in a fever dream, 2 inches above the left knee. The need to repair the mangled fingers on his left hand. And now this moment, the second day, coming off heavy medication. "My God, I'm alive," he thought. His dad, Glenn Cook, and his older sister, Cassie Cook Burns, had arrived. A doctor entered and said he was there to check Colin's vitals. Colin took the occasion to peek at his phone. "What are you looking at, Col?" Glenn asked. "Watching a live feed of the North Shore's waves," Colin said. Everyone chuckled. Then the doctor told Colin he'd be lucky to walk again. Colin stopped chuckling. Colin's mother, Mary Beth Cook, arrived next. The two had always been close. Before his parents divorced when Colin was little, Glenn had traveled a lot for work and Mary Beth had found ways to play to Colin's strengths. That meant dirt bikes for the son who thrilled to danger, as well as carpentry lessons from Mary Beth's father, because Colin could not sit through a school day. His ADHD diagnosis didn't resolve his troubles in school, which wrecked his confidence. Always shy, Colin became anxious as the years progressed. He had a few friends, but no large social circle, no long-term girlfriend. Mary Beth became his confidant, his center. She soothed his frustrations as he did his homework. She watched him surf, even in Rhode Island's frigid winters. Surfing quieted the story Colin told himself, that he was not good enough. He never thought he was good enough to be like his dad or his sister, just as he never thought he was good enough to turn pro. Other elite surfers in Oahu said he had the proficiency, but Colin couldn't get himself to say it. The same went for dating. He never found a girlfriend despite his chiseled build and kind manner, because any conversation with a girl turned awkward. Boy, I get that. Only Mary Beth and surfing could pull him from his most self-lacerating thoughts. In the hospital room, he drew her close. "Mom, when do you think I'll be on a board?" "One day," she told him, "you'll be back on your board one day." One day that week, the muscular Polynesian man who had saved Colin knocked on his hospital door. He said his name was Keone Bothorp. He was 33 with the square jaw and stubborn chin of an action movie star. Bothorp had three small kids and a wife. In the month prior to the attack, he had been tempted by a job on the mainland, he said. Yet some force had told him to stay on the islands, not just to stay there, but also to grow stronger as a surfer and swimmer. "God prepared me to save your life," Bothorp told Colin, "and God has been preparing to save your life too." Colin wanted to believe he could will his life back to its old existence, but after Bothorp left, he searched on his phone for surfers who'd lost a limb above the knee and returned to surfing. He found a few people in the world, none with a prosthetic that allowed them to surf the way they once did. "There's no way," he thought. Back to Boston. In the emergency room at Boston Medical Center, doctors told Kevin that they would have to amputate his wife's legs. He knew Celeste's life would always be cleaved now into before and after, but that was not the worst of it. Why hadn't he been able to find Sydney at the finish line? He'd been a few feet from behind Celeste and Sydney when the bomb exploded. He'd seen its force blow Sydney back. Celeste kept asking where Sydney was, and Kevin hadn't had the courage to tell her that he feared their daughter was dead. Now, with Celeste in surgery, Kevin bawled. 2 hours later, he and Tyler received word. Sydney was alive and here at Boston Medical. Doctors had to remove veins from her left leg to create, in essence, a new artery in her right leg. Soon, Sydney was conscious and recovering, and eventually was put in the same room as Celeste. Celeste, still groggy from her own surgery, saw her daughter. Matted hair, a gray complexion from the blood loss. She looked down at her own legs and what wasn't there, and then reached over to hold Sydney's hand. Colin, back to Oahu. Colin took his prosthetic leg in his hands and shimmied and grimaced and pulled until it was on. He was back in his childhood home in Tiverton, Rhode Island. Actually, Rhode Island, not Oahu. His dad lived here now, and Mary Beth rented a place nearby to help out while Colin recovered. Colin's new leg was a heavy, cumbersome, ill-fitting thing, and when he rose in the living room to try to walk, he stumbled to the floor. The nerve endings at the edge of the residual limb were causing him pain. The skin needed a callus over the limb and helped desensitize the nerves. Doctors told him it would take time to get comfortable with the prosthetic, but time passed and the situation did not improve. He could not walk more than a few paces before the pain and exertion overwhelmed him and he stumbled again to the floor. Surfing felt further and further away. The burgeoning reality of a diminished life followed him and his mother onto a flight to Orlando, Florida in February 2016. Colin relied on crutches to get around, and his dread trailed him right up to their destination, the 22,000-square-foot Prosthetic and Orthotic Associates. POA billed itself as different from other prosthetic centers. Its founder, Stan Patterson, had roughly a dozen patients and an on-site fabrication lab where a silicone cast of the residual limb would form the outline of, eventually, the perfect prosthetic, he told Colin. "We'll have you walking in a week." Colin scoffed. Patterson would succeed where the prosthetists up north with their Ivy League affiliations had failed? Patterson sensed Colin's doubt. He took Colin and his mother to the vast rehab room where they met a middle-aged patient with pearls and diamond bracelets wrapped around the ankles of her two prosthetics. Her name was Celeste Corcoran. Her Massachusetts accent made Colin and Mary Beth feel at home. Celeste told them about the bombing and the shared hospital room with her daughter. She had felt a sharp physical pain in the lower legs that were no longer there, a condition known as phantom limb syndrome. What was there had atrophied and seemed shriveled before her, just like her future. At night in the hospital, when she thought her daughter in the bed next to her was asleep, Celeste had sobbed. Mary Beth remembered seeing Celeste and Sydney on the Today Show after the bombing. Sydney's voice had been hoarse from her being intubated days earlier, but in that interview, they had refused to be victims. "If you have the spirit and you know that you want to do it, I can absolutely achieve it," Celeste had said. Celeste told Mary Beth and Colin how resilient and mature Sydney was. Her classmates at Lowell High had named her prom queen weeks after she was released from the hospital. Sydney chose a strapless cream-colored dress, walked in on crutches, and wore her crown when the TV cameras and photographers asked to see it. As Celeste showed them more recent photos of Sydney without her prom crown, her beauty still had an almost regal air. At the end of Colin's week at POA, Patterson helped him into a new custom prosthetic. Because of the company's patented process of using the silicone cast to shape a prosthetic rather than fitting a generic one onto an amputee's leg, the prosthetic fit snugly, without pain at the nerve endings of Colin's limb. Patterson demonstrated how to swing his hip to move his leg. Hip swing, step forward. Patterson walked alongside Colin and then drew back. Colin took his first steps. Tentative, unwieldy, still painful steps, but he was walking again. He let loose a yip of a laugh the way he used to out on the water. Taking it in, Mary Beth cried and looked at Celeste. She was crying too. Celeste and Mary Beth became both friends and co-conspirators. I can see where this is going, right? In the weeks after POA, after they returned to their respective homes, they settled on a goal. Somehow, get Colin and Sydney in the same room. Colin was oblivious to all this, as most of us men are, right? The success at POA had refined his obsession. Somehow, he had to surf again. The limited surfing prosthetics on the market all assumed the same thing. The surfer had lost a leg below the knee. An above-the-knee surfing prosthetic didn't exist. How would a company mimic the ball joint and the solidity of the knee and the individualized curvature of any one person's calf and foot? From his childhood living room, Colin sketched what his surfing leg might look like. Less a stiff metal rod than the curved blade that some Paralympic sprinters now favor. Its flexion could allow Colin to squat and pivot on the board. What he needed was a curved blade prosthetic that connected to a ball socket knee and then Stan Patterson's upper leg prosthetic that fit snugly to Colin's limb. Colin had two childhood friends, Brendan Pryor and Max Kramers, who were engineers in Rhode Island. He asked whether the carbon fiber they used on manufacturing projects might be used to create his new surfing leg. The trio's first iteration of an above-the-knee, surfing-ready prosthetic was fine for standing and walking, but the blade was too long for Colin to squat on his board. The next try had a blade of the right length, but the knee joint wasn't sturdy. That wasn't the only problem. As they made leg after leg, the trio noticed that the carbon fiber tip of the bladed lower leg, Colin's new foot, provided little balance when he pivoted laterally. They fit the blade inside a sneakered foot that they manufactured, but it slid off of wet surfaces. What about a foamed composite foot, they thought, something that absorbed water but didn't slide off the surface of the board? Within days, the three friends set about creating a foam foot, working with the same composite materials used in high-end sailboat racing. Soon, composite feet littered the floor of Colin's house. He wanted something sticky enough to pivot on a wet surface, but not so sticky that it felt glued down. No foot did exactly what Colin needed. Colin sketched small changes. His mom, who was back in Georgia where she now lived, kept nagging him about some charity event in North Chelmsford, Massachusetts, but it barely registered. For weeks, Colin kept his focus on his designs right up until the literal hour his dad told him they needed to leave for the event. The night was a fundraiser for 50 Legs, a nonprofit that helped cover the cost of prosthetics. After the marathon bombing, Celeste Corcoran had received her prosthetics from 50 Legs. She'd be there tonight as an honored guest, and Colin's parents told him that her daughter would be there too. It was a big event, almost 200 people, with hors d'oeuvres, a full bar, and a band. Oh man, Colin thought as he walked into the hall, this is going to be awkward. In a space this loud and cavernous, he could get so self-aware and ill at ease, he'd go mute. And now here came Celeste, fast-talking, high-energy Celeste, shaking Colin's hand and introducing herself to Glenn and ceding the floor to Sydney. By then, Sydney was 21, more than 3 years past the marathon bombing, and her black dress cut above the knees made no attempt to hide the surgical scars that ran along her toned right leg. You saw in her eyes what she told her mother. She was tired of immature boys. She hoped to meet a man, someone who'd been tested by life and was now confident from having endured those tests, the way she'd become. Nice to meet you, Colin said. He was flustered by Sydney's beauty, her maturity, above all his ever-nacking sense that whatever he said would be wrong, so he said little. Sydney walked away. Later, as Sydney and Celeste talked to stragglers across the room, Glenn decided to intervene. He walked over to Sydney. Hey, listen, Glenn said. This is how he's always been. If you want to try to connect, you need to get his number. She nodded. Her mother had told her what had happened at POA, how Colin had come to trust that he could walk again. Maybe he'd get why she had a tattoo of a lion across her back and the words "choose to live" on her wrist. She crossed the floor of the hall. Hey, she said when she got to Colin, if I gave you my number, would you ever text me? On their first date, Colin could barely eat because of his nerves, convinced he'd say something stupid. Then they went to a movie where they couldn't talk at all. Colin walked Sydney back to her Volvo SUV and didn't try to kiss her, didn't think he deserved to. He watched her drive away and he got back on the highway to Rhode Island. His phone rang. Sydney. She asked if he was still in the parking lot. When he said no, she said that was too bad. If he were, she'd drive back and give him a kiss. They agreed to a second date, which led to more dates, and for Colin, a sense of unease that he'd somehow screw up a good thing. Again, we've all been there, right? His anxiety peaked when he drove to the Corcoran's place north of Boston, where Sydney and her parents had moved after the bombing. It was a large house that had been configured for the wheelchair Celeste used when the pain in her legs became unbearable. Colin tried to be lighthearted with Celeste and Kevin, but in a moment when it was just Colin and Sydney in the living room, he turned to her. Isn't it weird that I'm an amputee? As in, how many amputees do you need in your life? She told him his experience didn't burden her. She liked it. His life was one she understood. She'd been that close to death too. Now she was here with him. In the days ahead, Colin called and texted, more playful in these messages with Sydney than he'd ever been with any other girl. Meanwhile, he and his buddies kept adjusting his surfing leg and foam composite foot. One day, he went to the beach and for the first time tested the leg. Out among Rhode Island's low and lolling waves, the knee buckled beneath him. The joint couldn't withstand his body weight and the water rushing against it. The foot kept slipping off the board. As he swam back, no well of despair rose within him, as it once would have. Was this Sydney's influence? He didn't know. He just redoubled his efforts. He and Pryor and Kramers tightened the flexion of the knee joint, hoping that a more rigid knee would support him on the board. Days later, Colin made a second trek to the beach. He felt as if he was close to creating not only a prosthetic that no one else in the world had, but also something like a new self. At the beach, he lifted his board and swam out. On the first big wave, he pushed up and the foot stuck. He maneuvered on the board, pivoted, water crashed against him, and the knee held. My God, I'm surfing, he said. When he got back to land, Sydney was the first person he told. The more he surfed, the better he felt, until he reached a decision. I want to win competitions with my new leg. I want to turn pro. To surf as a pro, though, meant that puny waves off Rhode Island or Massachusetts wouldn't do. Sydney and Colin decided to move to Southern California, where Colin had extended family and Sydney's administrative job had an office. Colin found the job designing surfboards in Oceanside, a beach town about an hour south of Los Angeles. They got a place near the water, and bit by bit, their lives fell apart. It was the distance from Sydney's family. Her mother was her inspiration and her brother her best friend. She didn't feel nearly as poised and confident now as everyone had always assumed she was. There was the bombing, and then the days, months, and she should be honest, years when she relived it. The dread had begun almost immediately after the bombing. She had nearly been killed in a car accident and then again at the Boston Marathon. The universe doesn't want me here. Death was following her. When she and her mother had shared that hospital room, Sydney stared at what the bomb had taken from Celeste. What had Sydney done wrong in her life for that to happen to her mother? She thought this all the time. Then her thoughts turned suicidal. The part of Sydney that still wanted to live held fast to the one thing she could still control, what she ate. She would limit it at any meal or just as often skip the meal entirely and work out like a fiend. The thoughts spun blacker in the weeks and months after the bombing, and so the workouts ran longer and anorexia took a still stronger hold. Then the nightmares began. In one, the most vivid, Sydney crawled through a U.S. Army obstacle course down in the mud, avoiding the barbed wire above, and then jumped to her feet and ran. Tracking her, gaining ground on her, were the Boston Marathon bombers, homemade explosives in their hands and hatred in their eyes. My goodness. She woke yelling and drenched in sweat. She tried therapy for the PTSD and anorexia. It helped, but the dark thoughts returned, or the nightmares did, or the desire to control it all did. She met Colin, and he offered an answer. After his attack, he said he was never scared of sharks. That astounded her. About 6 months into their relationship, he even convinced Sydney to travel to Hawaii with him and swim with the sharks there. She was nervous that day, but Colin wasn't. With local shark experts guiding them, including Keone Beauthorpe, Colin got into the ocean miles from the shores of Oahu and swam right next to the Galapagos sharks and reef sharks. They were close enough to touch. Back on land, he shrugged it off. The ocean is their home, he said. It amazed her, inspired her. Colin made her feel good, strong, especially when his own insecurities, like a searing self-doubt about making it as a surfer, rose up. Sydney, from the start, intuited how to buoy him and soothe him. She felt useful around Colin. In other words, she knew him better than he did. She felt loved, and this led her to love him all the more. But now in California, the dread returned. She realized she'd been able to help Colin only because of how well her mother and father and brother had helped her back in Massachusetts. Her homesickness wasn't a homesickness at all. It was the severing of an identity. Sydney felt unmoored in California, leading an existence that was as quietly bleak as it had ever been after the bombing. What made it harder was the way that Colin had thrived out here. With Sydney's encouragement, he had found Paralympic-style surfing competitions. The usefulness she offered no longer felt good. She cried every night, most mornings, and a good chunk of each afternoon. "Can you, like, try to be happy?" Colin asked. "I'm trying. I'm really trying." By 2019, Colin had won the U.S. Nationals twice, but faltered both times at the World Championship in California. At Worlds, the stage seemed too big, with too many other great surfers, too much searing self-doubt. Sydney reminded Colin, as he prepared for the 2020 Paralympic Championships, first a statewide competition, then nationals, then, if he qualified, the Worlds, that he himself talked of how he wanted to be more than a victim of his attack. Winning the World Championship would serve as evidence of a man who had not only bested that day, but moved beyond it. "You'll win when you can believe it," she told him. He took nationals, he took regionals, and then nationals again, and in mid-March 2020, in what would be the last days before the COVID-19 shut everything down, Colin stepped onto the beach of the International Surfing Association's World Parasurfing Championships held north of San Diego on the shores of La Jolla. When he got to La Jolla's waters for the first heat, his inner critic did what it always had done, quieted enough so Colin could focus on advancing to the next round. It went like this for 4 days. Colin won and won. In fact, he was the favorite heading into the finals. On that morning, the fifth and last, he thought about how he would screw this up because that's what he always did at Worlds. Sydney heard it, the self-talk that he mumbled before the previous two Worlds competitions, and frankly, at so many points during their four-year relationship. "I'm not sure I can do this. Why am I even here?" She looked deeply into his eyes. It stopped the talk and Colin's pacing. "You are a great surfer," she said. "Do this for the love of surfing." Soon, the three finalists hit the water. Colin Cook of the United States, Eric Dargent of France, and Naomichi Katsukura of Japan. Colin let the others take waves, waiting for the perfect one that he alone could ride. The world narrowed until there was only Colin and the waves and Sydney's mantra, "Do this for the love of surfing." The perfect wave crested and he rode it. Then another perfect one. He rode that too. When he reached the shore, the evidence from the judges was irrefutable. Colin was the world champion for adaptive surfing in the above-the-knee division. Colin and Sydney got married in April 2023, and they now live in Oahu. It was a risk moving still farther west from Lowell, but Sydney has found here what Colin has always cherished. On their afternoon hikes to the top of one of Oahu's lush mountain peaks, taking in the Pacific, or on their morning walks for coffee, Sydney likes the island's slowed-down life that dwells on the moments before them, which they've learned is all they really have. She's better. The dread, and in particular, the severing of self, are things of her past. She's also taken the advice she gives to Colin. She ignores the fear that rises when pursuing the life she wants. She's quit her 9-to-5 job, she never liked the corporate life, to make candles that she ships to an ever-burgeoning list of mainland clients. Surfing was an Olympic competition in last year's Summer Games, and adaptive surfers might be able to compete in future Paralympic Games. Colin's looking toward a time in which he might be Colin Cook, Paralympian. He even laughs at how big his dreams had become. Sydney still shapes them. She has to. Colin wakes in the morning, now wanting to surf, but is sometimes terrified that a shark will bite him. The PTSD took 6 years to surface, and these days, on the worst days, it keeps him from riding the waves. When his panic is a physical pain in his chest, Sydney guides him to the beach. She watches while he latches on his surfer's leg. Most days, she says nothing. Then he breathes out and, after a nod from her, tiptoes his way into the water. Just knowing she's back there, he'll later say but not be able to finish, for how much her presence on shore means to him in the water. By the time the first wave hits, he's fine. The new Colin. When he comes in, she's still there, and the two of them, holding hands, walk home. And there's a picture of Colin and Sydney here. They're two really good-looking people who have overcome things that most of us would have probably died from or wanted to die from, and have got a new life and a new outlook on life. And that was a very inspiring story. I hope you enjoyed it. Here's another story from Reader's Digest. This is the edition, by the way, from October, November, 2025. Unforgettable character. He is God's problem now. A son bids farewell to his father with a fittingly irreverent obituary. When Charles Beam sat down last October in his Houston home to write his father's obituary, he was stumped. "I'd never written an obituary before, so I decided to Google, what do you put in an obituary," he says. His father, Robert Beam, had died at age 74 after falling and hitting his head in his Clarendon, Texas apartment. Charles, 41, found the usual tips online about including a summary of the person's life and a list of survivors. Then he stumbled upon an obituary for a man from Centerbrook, Connecticut, which began, this is funny, "Joe Heller made his last undignified and largely irreverent gesture on September 8, 2019, signing off on a life, in his words, generally well-lived and with few regrets. When the doctors confronted his daughters with the news last week that your father is a very sick man, in unison they replied, 'You have no idea.'" The obituary then informed readers that Heller had left his family with a house full of junk, 300 pounds of birdseed, and various dead houseplants. "I read it and I thought, that sounds like something my dad would do," Charles said. "He made a lot of obscene gestures. Why not make his father's obituary as funny and unpredictable as he was in life?" Charles said he broke into a grin as he began typing the first sentence. "Robert Adolph Beam, in accordance with his lifelong dedication to his own personal brand of decorum, muttered his last unintelligible and likely unnecessary curse on October 6, 2024, shortly before tripping backward over some stupid freaking thing and hitting his head on the floor. From there, he was on a roll. Charles wrote about how his dad took up shooting in his later years and managed to blow not one, but two holes in the dashboard of his car. He described how his dad had a penchant for fashion and was frequently seen about town wearing the latest trend in homemade leather moccasins, a wide collection of unconventional hats, and boldly mismatched shirts and pants. We have all done our best to enjoy or weather Robert's antics up to this point, but he is God's problem now, Charles wrote at the end, advising everyone to wear whatever outdated or inappropriate clothing they like to his dad's farewell tour on October 14th in Amarillo, Texas. He sent the obituary to Robertson Funeral Directors, the Clarendon mortuary that was handling his dad's cremation. Owner Chuck Robertson says he almost choked on his breakfast from laughing when he read it. I told the people in the office, well, this is going to get us some attention, he said. I never had a family come through the doors that wrote an obituary as classic as that one. It immediately puts a smile on your face. As soon as Robert Adolph Baim's obituary appeared on the mortuary website and on Facebook, many more people than Clarendon's 2,000 residents read it. Robertson says, the unusual send-off has been viewed more than 1.4 million times. I knew a lot of people would love it, but I was shocked when it really started to blow up, Robertson says. Strangers from around the country left comments. I never met this man, but sure am sorry our paths didn't cross. If my family doesn't love me enough to do an obituary like this, I don't want it, wrote a commenter named Amber. Oh, Robert, you sound like the life of the party in more ways than one. I can only imagine the chaos in heaven now, someone from Virginia posted. A reader named Nikki summed it up for many others. To the person that wrote this obituary, please write mine. R.I.P., good sir. Charles says his father would be delighted that his legacy has caused a stir. There are some people who might think it was irreverent and offensive, but I think it sounds about perfect, he says in the obituary. To me, it pretty much describes my dad. Charles, the youngest of four children, said their father was an eccentric and upbeat man who had struggled since the death of his wife, Diane Beam, in February 2024. When I tried to get him some mental health help, he admitted to me he was scared and wanted me there with him, he says. We all visited him when we could, and the good people of Clarendon looked in on him and helped him out a lot. But it was hard for him, looking at my mom's empty chair, and I'm 600 miles away. As Charles packed up his father's belongings after his death, he says he realized his dad's spirit and character were much bigger than the sum of what he could haul away in a trailer. He recalled being homeschooled by his father after he started having problems at school. I was always a tinkerer, and so was my dad, he says. He'd take me to junk stores to buy little gadgets so I could take them apart, and he'd get me lots of textbooks from the library. He made sure I understood the material, and he set an expectation that I'd study until I could answer every question, says Charles, who received a GED diploma when he was 16. His dad worked a lot of jobs and finally settled on being a truck driver. For a while, my parents were team drivers, and for at least a year or two, I actually lived on the truck with them, Charles says. I got to see a lot. I read hundreds of books, and I learned how to sleep in a car anywhere in the lower 48. One of his favorite memories happened about 2 years ago, when his dad accompanied him and his three sons on a camping trip. Dad was trying to make coffee in his tent at night using this homemade burner thing, and he started a small fire and burned a hole in the tent, he recalls. He cussed about that for the rest of the night. As Charles wrote the obituary, he couldn't resist adding that his dad's apartment was full of historical weapons and a selection of harmonicas that he kept on hand so his dogs could howl along and entertain the neighbors. As Charles reflected on his dad's life, especially his final years, he gave special thanks to the people of Clarendon for looking in on his father and putting up with his antics. I've had to say, if I want anything to come from all this, it's for people everywhere to support the mental health of people in little rural towns, he says. They go there to retire, then when they're old, their kids scatter and they end up alone. A lot of people slip through the cracks. There are people all over the country, just like my dad, he says. We need to look after them. There's a picture of Robert and his dad, Robert and his wife, Diane, and there's also a picture of Charles and Robert in a picture here. His dad standing there in the picture, smoking a cigarette. You just gotta love it. So here is the actual obituary that was written. Robert Adolph Baim, May 6, 1950 to October 6, 2024. Robert Adolf Beam, in accordance with his lifelong dedication to his own personal brand of decorum, muttered his last unintelligible and likely unnecessary curse on October 6, 2024, shortly before tripping backward over some stupid freaking thing and hitting his head on the floor. Robert was born in Winters, Texas, to the late Walter Beam and Betty Smith on May 6, 1950, after which God immediately and thankfully broke the mold and attempted to cover up the evidence. Raised Catholic, Robert managed to get his wife, Diane, pregnant three times, fast enough to just barely miss getting drafted into the Vietnam War by fathering Michelle, John, and Charlotte between 1967 and 1972. Much later, with Robert possibly concerned about the brewing conflict in Grenada, Charles was born in 1983. This lack of military service was probably for the best, as when taking up shooting as a hobby in his later years, he managed to blow not one, but two holes in the dashboard of his own car on two separate occasions, which unfortunately did not even startle, let alone surprise his dear wife Diane, who was much accustomed to such happenings in his presence, and may have actually been safer in the jungles of Vietnam the entire time. While the world was in conflict elsewhere, Robert made do by learning to roof and to maintain traffic signs with the city of Amarillo, and eventually became becoming a semi-professional truck driver, not to be confused with a professional semi-truck driver. With peace on the horizon, Robert's attention somewhat counterintuitively drifted to weapons of war, spanning the historical and geographical spectrum from the atlatl of 19,000 BC France to the jambok of 1830s of Africa to the Mosin-Nagant M1891 of World War II era Soviet Union. So many examples of these mainstream hobbyist items litter his small Clarendon, Texas apartment that one of them may very well have been the item referenced in his aforementioned eloquent final epitaph, the one he tripped over. A man of many interests, Robert was not to be entranced by historical weapons alone, but also had a penchant for fashion, frequently seen about town wearing the latest trend in homemade leather moccasins, a wide collection of unconventional hats, and boldly mismatched shirts and pants. Robert also kept a wide selection of harmonicas on hand, not to play personally, but to prompt his beloved dogs to howl continuously at odd hours of the night and to entertain his many neighbors, and occasionally to give to his many, many grandchildren and great-grandchildren to play loudly during long road trips with their parents. Oh, you gotta love it, right? Earlier this year in February, God finally showed mercy upon Diane, getting her the hell out of there for some well-earned peace and quiet. Without Diane to gleefully entertain, Robert shifted his creative focus to the entertainment of you, the fine townspeople of Clarendon, Texas. Over the last 8 months, if you have not met Robert or seen his roadshow yet, you probably would have soon. We have all done our best to enjoy or weather Robert's antics up to this point, but he is God's problem now. Robert's farewell tour will be held on Monday, October 14, 2024 at 10 a.m. at Memorial Park Funeral Home, 6969 East Interstate 40 Highway, Amarillo, Texas, 79118. The family encourages you to dust off whatever outdated or inappropriate combination of clothing you have available to attend. A tip jar will be available in the front. Flowers are also acceptable. That is a great story and an absolutely incredible obituary for your father. I wish I had done something like that. That's amazing. Hope you enjoyed it. I certainly did. We're going to finish this week with a story from Outside Magazine from winter 2025. It's called Return to the Wild, about Joel Edgerton, who's a movie star. Grew up on the edge of an Australian forest, spending days building imaginary worlds among the trees. Now he's bringing the movie, the series Train Dreams, Dennis Johnson's wilderness epic, to the screen, and wondering what we've lost in our race away from the wild. There's a particular kind of actor who feels equally at home in the wilderness and on the red carpet, who understands that the demands of the body and the demands of the spirit are not separate things. Joel Edgerton is that actor. Someone who grew up on the edge of a vast forest in Australia, who ice plunges in London's Hampstead Heath, who collects vintage military boots and speaks about the woods with genuine reverence. He is, in other words, someone who has never quite left the wild places that made him. Over two decades, Edgerton has built a career of quiet virtuosity, the kind that doesn't announce itself but accumulates like sediment. Directing The Gift, a gem of a subversive psychological thriller, both producing and starring in award contenders like Loving and Boy Erased, and managed to steal the scene no matter how small or large the role, from Warrior to The Great Gatsby. He's become that rare figure in contemporary cinema, an actor, director, producer whose work consistently operates at the intersection of craft and conscience. You get the sense that he's always seeking the human truth. In his latest project called Train Dreams, a Netflix release that is streaming now, Edgerton plays Robert Grenier, a logger and railroad worker whose life unfolds across six decades in the forests of the Pacific Northwest. Based on Dennis Johnson's luminous novella, the film follows Grenier from the turn of the 20th century through the 1960s as he witnesses America transform around him. Railroads replacing horse trails, the wilderness giving way to civilization, his simple way of life becoming a relic. It's a role that demands something rare, the ability to convey profound emotional depth through stillness, through the language of the body and the land itself. Director Clint Bentley describes Edgerton as someone you feel like you could meet on a construction crew and he would fit in right as easily there as he does on the set of a Star Wars movie. Edgerton famously got his Hollywood start as Uncle Owen in Star Wars Episode II, Attack of the Clones. But there's something deeper at work. Edgerton brings to Grenier a kind of authentic understanding, not just of labor or landscape, but of what it means to be a human being caught between two worlds, the person you are and the person the world demands you become. It's a meditation on solitude, loss, and what it means to live in harmony with the natural world even as it disappears around you. We caught up with Edgerton from his home near Hampstead Heath in London, where he'd just finished a photo shoot in that very park. Over the course of our conversation, we talked about wild places, what drew him to this story, and what it means to belong to something larger than yourself. Outside Magazine. You made your home near Hampstead Heath, where these photos were taken. What's your relationship with that park? During the good parts of the year, I go down there with the kids most days. I put them in a box bike and ride them into the park, particularly when they were too young to walk. It's rambly with all these different environments, but it's mostly a forested kind of park, like a left-alone park with pathways. Occasionally, I get convinced by a friend of mine to go into the freezing cold ponds there and do a semi-Wim Hof kind of plunge. Do you enjoy that? Well, I wouldn't say it's enjoyable, but I get something from it, if you know what I mean. I do it because I know that the feeling of the result is good. Holds up a note. Did the photographer tell you about this? No, what's that? In the middle of a log, I found the note, folded and shoved in the middle of soil and wood chips. The writing is kind of prose, but sort of poetry. I was here, I followed every pole, every sign, every thread that led me to this spot. And it ends by saying, maybe somewhere down the line, you'll pull too and find me. That's remarkable, people leaving these intimate traces of themselves in the forest. Even in London, people are still seeking that connection with wild places. Some people like to go and find solace in isolation, you know, use parks as a way to go and think about things. It made me realize, too, that even in the city, you can be lonely. You got lots of people passing you every day, but you don't know any of them. There might be a movie in those notes for you. I noticed your aura ring in these photos. How's your sleep been? My sleep score last night was only 59, which annoyed me like crazy. Travel affects things, but I'm determined to get more and better sleep. The aura ring, that's O-U-R-A, has changed my relationship to alcohol. And that has a lot to do with seeing your stats in the morning. I love the thing. I had to take it off my hand when I was shooting, but I wear it between scenes and throughout the night. I didn't know you were such a sleep nerd. I understand you're into rock climbing as well. I love it, but I have to admit to the fact that most of the rock climbing I've done has been indoors. I'm a little bit obsessive about it, but I put myself in the okay category with everything outdoors. When did you get into the sport? When I was in my early 20s, my brother was a stunt guy, still is, and he used to go up to the Blue Mountains in Sydney to do climbing and rappelling for work. I used to tag along with him. Then I started climbing when I was living in Melbourne. One time I was on my way to this mountain range in Victoria to go climbing with some friends, and I got a call from the producer of a TV show I was working on. She asked, "What are you doing this weekend?" I said, "I'm just on my way down to the Arapiles to go climbing." Her tone of voice changed. "No, you're not. You're not insured for that." Insurance getting in the way of fun. Yeah, when you're an actor, you often sign a clause in your contract which says you won't engage in certain activities. They don't want to be a month into shooting for their show and find out you decided to go bungee jumping for the first time. I like surfing, and I wouldn't want anybody to tell me I can't do that. If you're familiar with the thing and it's part of the fabric of your life, then why would they try to stop you from doing that? Isn't life kind of dangerous all by itself? This film seems physically demanding. You're out there in nature, which is very much a character in this movie. Yeah, it was, and I love that. The times I get to shoot movies in the wilderness feel comfortable because I grew up in a very rural place in Australia, right on the edge of the Birora Valley National Park. As a kid, I felt like there was no fence line between our property and the park, like we had the most expansive property in the world. That was my playground, this never-ending forest. The wilderness is tough for the crew and their equipment, but it's not the toughest environment for an actor. It's a real pleasure to be off the grid a little bit. I imagine it's like camping for work. Train Dreams is the spare poetic novella, 116 pages that somehow contain an entire life. What was it about Grenier's story that made you want to bring it to the screen? I was a big fan of the novella about 7 or 8 years before Clint even contacted me about doing the film. The book opens with Robert trying to wrangle a Chinese worker who's supposedly done something wrong, and he participates in this act of violence without realizing what he's doing. I thought, this is a Western. But it didn't go down the typical roads of the retribution template. It became a philosophical rumination on life. That really got its talons into me. The typical point of view on the modern history of America is that the Wild West was all about gunslingers in the desert. Train Dreams had a different aspect. The logging industry, the building of the railroads, it was less about good guys and bad guys and violence, and more about the journey and the hard work. How did you prepare for the physical demands of the role? Did you spend time with loggers? Clint and I shared something in common. His grandfather had been a logger, and my grandfather had been a train driver. And my grandfather and great-grandfather came from a farming background. They were sheep farmers and bullock drivers. I always felt an affinity for people who worked the land because my life is relatively easy, and I spend it pretending to be people who are tougher than I really am. Clint brought in a lot of guys involved in the logging industry, and we had really evocative materials from the era. When you look at photographs of the logging industry from the late 1800s and early 1900s, you realize just how hard that work would have been. Double-handed saws and axes, a team of 10 or so men working on one monster tree. There are photos of 7 or 8 men all lined up, sitting side by side in the wedge cut into a single tree trunk. You can only imagine how brutal that work must have been. There's something about manual labor in the wilderness that changes you. The repetition, the physicality. Did you experience any of that transformation during filming? There was an interesting exercise when we first started putting Robert's pack together. He's out there for weeks on end, so we had to think, what would you put in one backpack if you had to make a journey for months? We chose the pragmatic objects, things you could cook with, his logging boots and axe, which is precious to him, and a few trinkets of sentimental value. Being out in the wilderness with your life reduced to one pack, I think it's an exercise everybody should do, at least mentally. Ask yourself what is truly important. You realize how much of what we have isn't really that important and how much crap we accumulate. I've got so much crap everywhere. If you had to go out in the woods for a month, what would you pack? He laughs. You just reminded me. When we were kids, my brother had a spy kit and I had a survival kit. We'd go on survival courses for 3 days and learn how to start a fire and all that. But I'm not going on Naked and Afraid, and that's certain. If I were a real survivor, I'd take something to start a fire and a weapon. I'm not an advocate of guns, but if my life were under threat from savage animals or a zombie apocalypse, I'd have a gun. Something to sanitize water by boiling it. Plastic sheets to collect water. I remember wrapping a eucalyptus tree with a plastic bag overnight as a kid, and in the morning you'd have half a cup of fresh water. Shelter. Waterproof gear. I still feel like I've got 2/3 of my pack left empty. Oh, and I'd take some Vegemite. Vegemite. Why? And for those who don't know what Vegemite is, can you explain it? It's a salty, yeast-like paste that you put on toast. I don't know if it's an acquired taste, but Australians either grow to love it or were built with a different taste buds because most people from other parts of the world were like, yuck. But as my brother's niece said, don't yuck my yum. I think it's really good. That's a great line. Don't yuck my yum. A lot of time passed between when you first read the book to making the movie. Did your perspective on Train Dreams change over time? It's funny how train dreams change for me, and this is probably true of all literature and music. Your perspective on art shifts at different points in your life. I was very taken with the novella when I read it at age 44, but I wasn't a father then. Reading the novella and Clint and Greg Quidar's screenplay as a father, I found it more emotionally devastating. I didn't have to imagine having kids to understand what it would be like to lose them. My relationship to the book completely changed, and I think it made me more suitable for the film. One of the most powerful threads in the story is watching the wilderness literally disappear. The film has this interesting tension. It's clearly historical, but it feels eerily modern now. Did making this film change how you think about our relationship with wild places? The filming didn't change how I feel about nature. I already believe the world needs to be treated better, but the film speaks to an interesting way through characters from decades past with a spirituality that's both naive and wise. William H. Macy's character, Arn, has this instinctive understanding that the trees are ancient. He says it hurts a man's soul to take down a tree like that. These ideas are naive, but wise and rich. Then Carrie Condon's character, Claire, a conservationist, says that all of nature is intricately stitched together. Organisms, animals, and humans are all part of the same ecosystem. The dying tree is as important as the living one, she says. Her ideas bring us closer to the modern understanding of the world as a delicate ecosystem. The film addresses the violence and treatment of immigrants, the harvesting of the planet, and the emergence of new technology. There's a moment where Robert can't get a petrol chainsaw to work, and he's staring at it like we're staring at AI right now. While we're looking back in time, the film is talking about things still relevant today. Love, family, loss, but also immigration and technology. Question. There's something about people who choose to live in wild places. What does Robert understand that maybe we've lost? The films remind you of how rich the world is to us and how precious it is and how fragile. We need the creators and builders and active human beings, but the patient ones are also important. The peaceful, patient humans hold things more precious. Again, there's that line, God needs the hermit in the woods as much as he needs the man in the pulpit. That illuminates something for me. The isolated human versus the communal one, the nonverbal one versus the verbal. A big part of my imagination was born out of where I lived. I dream my kids get that connection, that patience, that understanding that we belong to the land rather than owning it. And that was a great interview with Joel Edgerton, who's been in a whole lot of different movies. I remember him from Zero Dark Thirty. Remember the story about the killing of Osama bin Laden? But he has been in a lot of stuff, and he will eventually someday get an Oscar. I guarantee that. So if you're looking for a good movie, it's on Netflix again. It's called Train Dreams with Joel Edgerton. And it's a look back in the past in the late 1800s to the early 1900s of the logging industry in the Pacific Northwest. So check out Train Dreams. That's all we have for today. Please stay tuned for next week, when we bring it to you again, and listen to all the great programming right here on Mind's Eye, your virtual newsstand. Take care, everybody.